medicine improves, are we becoming less healthy? Why do we grow fatter the more we diet? Why, despite our technological advances, are we facing environmental devastation? Those are some of the questions writer Nathaniel Johnson sets out to answer in his new book, All Natural, a skeptic's quest to discover if the natural approach to diet, childbirth, healing, and the environment really keeps us healthier and happier. Do we have to choose between science and nature? How do you find balance? It's your call with me, Holly Kernan, and you after this news.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. French troops fighting Islamist insurgents in Mali have given conflicting accounts of their progress in taking the northern town of Kidal, the last main rebel stronghold. They said initially they had entered the town, but the French defence minister said later that the troops had been unable to leave the airport there because of a sandstorm. There are suggestions that the rebels linked to Al-Qaeda had already left the town. Thomas Fessy in Timbuktu is monitoring developments.
Kidal is just near the Algerian border, and that was the home of the Islamist group of Ansar Din. And we understand that its leader, Iyad Aghali, was able to flee the town with its fighters in the surrounding mountains just over the weekend before the French-led forces arrived and secured the town. What we also understand is that the former Tuareg rebels of the MNLA had arrived before the French soldiers.
The Senate, a former U.S. congresswoman who narrowly survived a gunshot wound to the head, has appeared before a Senate committee to call for urgent action on gun violence. Gabrielle Giffords, who was seriously injured in a mass shooting in Arizona 2 years ago, told the hearing that too many children were dying and gun reform was needed.
It will be hard, but the time is now. You must act. Be bold, be courageous. Americans are counting on you.
The Senate hearing is the first since last month's massacre at a school in Connecticut, which refocused the attention of Americans on the issue of gun control. Official estimates suggest that the United States economy unexpectedly shrank in the final quarter of last year at an annual rate of 0.1%. Public spending cuts, including a sharp reduction in defence spending, are being partly blamed for the figures. However, economists are also pointing to more optimistic data, such as the buoyant housing sector, increased business and consumer spending, and more jobs being created. Russia has ended a 10-year-old agreement with the United States on cooperation over drugs control and law enforcement. The announcement was made days after the US pulled out of a joint commission on civil liberties. From Moscow, here's Steve Rosenberg.
Ever since Vladimir Putin returned to the Kremlin last May, a chill has returned to US-Russian relations. The two countries seem locked in a spiral of mutual suspicion and Cold War-style tit-for-tat. The recent Magnitsky bill has sparked particular fury in the Kremlin. This US law bars Russian officials suspected of human rights violations from entering America and freezes any US assets they may have. Now Moscow has torn up an agreement with Washington on the fight against drug trafficking. There seems little prospect of an imminent thaw.
World News from the BBC. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has begun a visit to Algeria, promising closer security cooperation with the region in the wake of the hostage crisis that claimed nearly 40 lives, six of them British. Our political editor, Nick Robinson, has travelled to Algeria with Mr. Cameron.
The message that he's been giving to reporters in midair is that, yes, Algeria and the countries of North Africa and what happens here counts massively for people at home. But above all, he said, that the threat is to the countries of this region themselves, and that what he is about is trying to help the countries of what he called this neighbourhood help themselves.
International donors at a United Nations conference in Kuwait have pledged more than the target of $1.5 billion in humanitarian aid for those affected by the Syrian conflict. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon said he was pleased that the goal of the meeting had been met. Police in Bangladesh have arrested the chairman and managing director of a clothing factory following a fire that killed seven female workers last weekend. From Dhaka, Anbarasan Etirajan reports.
The arrest came after the father of one of the victims filed a complaint alleging negligence by the owners of Smart Fashions Limited. The blaze over the weekend completely destroyed the upper floor of a two-story building in Dhaka. More than 300 workers were inside the factory when it caught fire. It is still not clear what started the blaze. Officials said the factory did not have a valid fire safety certificate.
The European Union Police Agency says one of the largest ever operations has been carried out against a network suspected of smuggling illegal migrants into Europe. Europol said more than 100 people had been arrested in coordinated raids across 10 countries. And finally, in football, Togo and Tunisia are playing a match that will determine the last quarter-final place in the Africa Cup of Nations. At halftime, it was 1-1. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Nathaniel Johnson grew up in the kind of house where kids ate a lot of kale and brown rice, played outside in the woods, and sang together before dinner. His parents tried to raise their kids the natural way. And for a long time, Nathaniel thought that was the best way. So when his wife became pregnant with their daughter, Nate had a newly personal stake in figuring out how to live well. He set about trying to locate the truth he thought might lie between the unquestioning acceptance of the natural and the slavish devotion to the modern. The result is the new book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover if the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment really keeps us healthier and happier. He writes, ecological anxiety has polarized a new generation of Americans. Some are drawn to natural solutions and organic lifestyles, while others rally around high-tech development and industrial efficiencies. It's this very divide, he argues, that keeps us from finding true solutions. Johnson is a journalist whose work has appeared in Harper's, New York Magazine, California Watch, This American Life, and on KALW in San Francisco. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's always so wonderful to be back at KALW.
So tell us about, you write a lot in your book, All Natural, about your childhood and its influence in getting you to go on this skeptic's quest. You grew up in Nevada City in California, which is a town that is full of this duality, right? You've got your redneck loggers and your back-to-nature hippies. Tell us about that place.
Well, I was born in Berkeley, and at a certain point when I was old enough to start walking and falling down and skinning my knees on the concrete, my dad decided that we really needed to get back to nature where the ground was softer and technology wasn't going to hurt the children. And so we moved to Nevada City, and they chose Nevada City because there were a lot of like-minded people up there. In the late 60s and early 70s, some Bay Area bohemians and artists had started moving up there and forming communes and forming communities, and there's spiritual retreats up there, all of this type of stuff. There was a health food store already set up, and so they were drawn to that side of things. But at the same time, there's also the people that were there before the hippies started coming in. There were the loggers and the miners and just the good, solid American Christian Republican businessmen that, and so those were the people that I got to know as I was growing up as well. So I really was torn between these two extremes.
And you write in your book that you had this revelation where your questioning started when you were swimming in a local lake.
Right.
And then you started to question this all-natural approach. Explain that.
Yeah, so this was the moment that it all came tumbling down for the very first time. And the issue was we were at this potluck. This is shortly after we'd moved to Nevada City. And my parents had gone to this potluck to kind of meet other people around town. And so it's summer, the mosquitoes are buzzing around the casserole, and people are filling up their plates, and all of the kids are swimming in the pond. And we hadn't really come prepared. We didn't have swimming suits, but we didn't ever really have swimming suits at all, because around my household, nudity was kind of the norm. If it was warm enough, we were naked. And so my parents said, oh yeah, sure, go into the water, no problem. And there was this platform out in the middle of the lake, and all the kids were jumping off and pushing each other off of the platform. And so I swim out to the platform, and I'm so excited to just tussle with all of these kids. And I pull myself up, and I'm ready to take everyone on, but instead... Everything gets very quiet.
And then because you're naked and everybody else is wearing swimsuits?
Yes, you know, this is a moment that we all experience, but most of us just experience it in our dreams. You know, you show up to work and you're naked. I got to live the dream. And this little girl is like, he's naked, he's naked. And they all, like, ran. They all dove off the other side. And it was like I was the, you know, the evil crustacean monster in one of those 1950s horror movies that comes and terrorizes the beach party. And this really, I mean, you know, it's a funny story, but it also was the first time I really felt ashamed of the way that I have been brought up. And I started to wonder if this ideology that my parents had given me that I held so closely to my heart might actually be doing me harm.
And so that's kind of the kernel in this skeptic's quest in Nathaniel Johnson's book, All Natural. I won't read the subtitle because it's really, really long. I'll read it soon. I want you to give us one more anecdote that kind of sets up this conflict between whether, you know, the back to nature approach and the scientific technological advancements can coexist. So you told me this story, which is also in your book, that I have never forgotten, about you and your brother are huddling outside in the cold, looking through your glass window at your house. Why? Tell this story.
So when my parents got a computer in the 80s, they were very reluctant. They decided they needed to keep up with the world a little bit and get a computer. And they got this funny amber screened IBM clone. And this was just like such a magical, amazing thing that me and my brother were drawn to. And they were very nervous about the degree to which we were entranced by this. And so they made a rule that we could be on the computer for half an hour every day. But in order to earn that half an hour, we had to be outside for 3 hours. And this worked pretty well, except when it was winter. And so this was a day in which it was just freezing cold. It was raining. It wasn't quite snowing, but it felt almost colder because it was so wet and the rain was coming down. But me and my brother were determined to get our 3 hours in. And so we're huddled together on the covered porch with our backs up against the glass door, and we have this big dirty blanket over us, and we're just sitting there shivering in the cold. And my little brother had a clock with him, a little mobile clock, and every once in a while we'd look at it and say, how many minutes has it been? He'd pull it up and 3 minutes. And you know, we'd have then 2 hours and 57 minutes to go.
And so you were wondering, is this, you know, is this actually healthier than
exactly
you sitting at the...
It seems like maybe, just maybe, it would be healthier for us to be inside in the warmth in front of that cozy amber-screened computer than outside in the rain.
And in some ways, these childhood experiences set up this skeptic's quest. We're talking with Nathaniel Johnson. He's the author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And he'll be in conversation with Michael Pollan this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. I think you can still get tickets for that. We have a link to it at yourcallradio.org. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And you write in your book about modern medicine, farming, environmental issues like forestry. So I'd like to have you tell us about some of these things. One of the most fascinating part looks at modern farming and our modern food system, and your exploration into how hog farming works started in a bar.
Right. And I was living in Burley, Idaho, in southern Idaho, this tiny little town where I got hired on as a cub reporter at the local newspaper. And one of my friends worked at a hog farm just outside of town. And we were having a beer together at this bar, the one decent bar in town. It was a very pious Mormon town, so it was kind of hard to, you had to kind of duck in guiltily into the bar. And she was telling me that, gosh, she had just had such a hard day at work. And sometimes these sows, these female pigs, when you get in there and start to stimulate them, they just go berserk and knock her down and trample her into the... And I said, wait a second, stimulate? What exactly do you do for your job? And what she did was artificially inseminate these pigs all day long. And that was just
which
kind of...
Which sounds insane.
Right. It really threw me for a loop. I thought, if this is how my bacon is made, what else don't I know? And so I ended up on this this long quest to really figure out what made this logical. Because if you understand the way the entire system works, it makes perfect sense.
But you'll stop eating if you understand how the whole system works.
Well, maybe that too. It definitely changed the way that I eat.
So tell us just a little bit more about how this does work.
Right. So tracing artificial insemination really goes back to the need for uniformity. If you can take one boar's semen and use that to inseminate every pig on your giant network of farms, then you can get identical pigs, and this will lead to identical pork. And there was really this push from starting with Smithfield Farms, the largest pork producer in the world, to make farming more like auto production. And they wanted to follow this industrial standard in which they could control the process from beginning to end and give the customers a reliable, unchanging product at the end. And so they expanded massively. They controlled, they gave the farmers the pigs. They controlled the genetics of the pigs, and then they would send out this the same semen, and so they could get the same pigs. And there's a lot of other steps in between, but in all, this became, it was so much more efficient for them. So I say it ended up with less farm hands on the job, but more hand jobs on the farm.
And sorry, that's really funny. And a lot of this is driven by our consumer desire for cheap food, right?
For cheap food and for reliably conforming food, not necessarily better food. In many ways, the pork that came out was an inferior product, but it was the same product. People knew what they were going to get every single time.
And you also talked with a lot of farmers who disagreed with this kind of approach, that were doing more organic farming that was done in a humane way, where animals and the people working on the farm were treated better, but it's hard to make a living that way.
Yeah, it's harder to make a living. The pinch point comes back to us. If we're willing to pay a little bit more money for our meat, and maybe instead of eating meat every single day, have it a little bit more rarely and have it be a special occasion, or making the meat more of a seasoning in your vegetables rather than the main course.
Which was generally a traditional human diet, right?
That's much more of the way that if you look at primitive cultures, most eat a more plant-based diet. I mean, there are exceptions. You can see the Inuit have an almost exclusively meat-based diet, and they're very healthy, but they have some very special things going on. You know, they're eating tons of fish with high omega-3 fatty acids and all sorts of things that we probably don't even completely understand. They're fermenting things for months and then eating this sort of gooey mess, and we don't know all of what's going on in the nutrition of that. But the point is that if we're willing to pay just a little bit more for meat, then we can support these much more humane practices.
And Nate, I want to take a call, but first let me invite the rest of our listeners to join our conversation. We're speaking with Nathaniel Johnson, who's the author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and you can join our conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. What does the word natural mean to you? And when applied to your life, your activities, and the stuff you buy, what does it mean? Have you noticed all these labels cropping up that say all natural but don't really tell you what that means? 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you're trying to live consciously and ecologically, do you find technology helpful in doing that? And do you have stories of choices you've made between the natural and ecological and technological? That's 866-798-TALK. A toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, hey, morning. Great show. You know, I wanted to ask your guest if he was familiar with Thomas Jefferson in his first inaugural made a comment about how he wanted to make the economy based upon agriculture with commerce as its handmaiden. And so the very idea that nature essentially should be more important than the crazy dreams of commerce.
And that's a question that Nate takes on in a big way in this book. Thanks for that, David.
The Jeffersonian ideal of, I think that the core of that is having an economy that pays attention to the land, that is fundamentally sustainable, rather than the economy running amok. And if it's not sustainable, then we'll leave that to the next generation to deal with.
And you tell another story in this book that illustrates this conflict and a solution about sort of the environmentalists that wanted to preserve the redwoods versus the people who wanted to, you know, build houses and get timber, and how they did make, you know, find some compromises around these economic and environmental questions.
Right. Yeah. This is up near where I grew up. So it wasn't redwood. It's ponderosa pine and sugar pine.
Sorry.
These things are very important to me as someone who's paid a lot of attention to trees growing up. But this is an example where instead of seeing industry and nature is fundamentally opposed, it's really a hopeful example to me, because it's an example where human industry actually has enhanced the natural wilderness. And what happened was that there was a plan to give away all of this Bureau of Land Management forest up there to, not to give it away, they were going to trade for other land elsewhere, but they were going to trade it to Sierra Pacific Industries, the biggest landowner in California that essentially is a clear-cutting operation. And the people there didn't like this idea. And so they lobbied their BLM administrator and
Bureau of Land Management.
Yes. and this guy was a really interesting guy. He wasn't your average bureaucrat. He was a Marine helicopter pilot who'd just come back from Vietnam, and he'd worked his way up to this position. But when he'd gotten this desk job, he had vowed that he was going to look the people that he worked with in the eye and touch the soil. And so he went up to meet with these people, and he was confronted by all of these sandal-wearing hippies, essentially, who were saying, "You can't do this. You know, we, the Indians chant here and the Buddhists pray here." And he's like, "Give me a break." But he also saw a real spark of intelligence and a potential for common understanding with these people. And he said, "Look, here's what we'll do. If you guys can find a way to manage this land, to take the facts on the ground and use that to creatively work something out, I'll get the federal government to back it." And they did. It was really hard. It took years of work 6 years of negotiating. And, you know, there's one story where there's a meeting and this woman came up and they were talking about clearing some brush so everything didn't burn down. And she was like almost in tears saying, please don't cut down the manzanita. And, you know, the manzanita is like this weed up in Nevada City. But they worked their way all the way through that. And now it's a really remarkable place. They're growing the trees. They're doing a very selective harvesting method where they wait until the trees are very large so you can get high-value, beautiful timber that you can sell for much more. And the wilderness has gotten more and more healthy. Different species just booming in population.
So they were able to actually balance these two needs and care for the forest so that people could still enjoy it, its beauty.
Yeah, and not just balance, but enhance the two. There's a real synergy there. And, you know, the beauty in the forest then is reflecting the beauty in the houses because this beautiful timber yields beautiful construction.
So there's one example of finding balance. I want to try and go to one call before the break. Let's go to Gina in Oakland. Hi, Gina. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I think I like what you're saying, but what you just said about the manzanita, you know, the indigenous people in this country hold manzanita as very sacred. So to call it for a white person or whatever your color is, I don't know, to just dismiss it like that is kind of hurtful.
Well, here, Gina, let's get a response, and then you can ask your question.
I have other things.
Well, let me let Nate respond to that.
I can just speak to that quickly.
Yeah,
I think that so manzanita, it's a little bit different here in the Bay Area, where it's almost an ornamental as opposed to where I grew up, where it just chokes the hillsides. It's the main species of the chaparral. And Native Americans controlled the manzanita. They used the manzanita. You can brew a tea from the berries. I ate the berries all through my childhood growing up. But also, they would have burns, and they would create environments there. And so to simply say we need to let it do its thing completely and allow for the catastrophic wildfires every once in a while that completely wipes everything out is breaking with that tradition, I think.
Okay, so thanks. Gina, go ahead. I know you had more to say in a question. Yeah.
You didn't say that, so that's important because the burning, they haven't been allowed to do that.
Well, thanks for keeping us on our toes.
Yeah, but I've got something else to say.
Go ahead.
About the diet. I have candida and leaky gut, and I can't handle grains and beans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would think that, you know, 85% of my diet is vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to have some chicken every day with that, and I kind of use it as a condiment. And eggs, but I don't do beef or any of the other heavy stuff. And I live, it's very strange to be in this society because a lot of people don't live the way I do, pretty naturally, you know, and recycled and scavenged things, and I don't buy things. And, there's still a prestige factor in this culture about you got to have the car, you got to have the new clothes, especially Grand Lake area of Oakland where I live.
I would say there's still a prestige factor. That's the prestige factor is the norm.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to
yeah.
stop both of you because we've got to go to a break. So stay on the line with us, Gina, and we'll get a response from Nate. Oh, I think we just lost her. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking about some of the paradoxes of modern life. As medicine improves, are we becoming less healthy? Why, when we diet, do we become more, are we often becoming more fat? We're talking with Nathaniel Johnson, who's the author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And do you have to choose between science and nature? Have we in the modern world fallen out of sync with nature? culture? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And Nate is going to be in conversation with Michael Pollan tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. You can get tickets for that event. We'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. And again, you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. You can join us on the phone at 866-798-8255. Or if you prefer to write, send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. You can sign up for our newsletter or send a show idea to yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the value of national parks. Just this month, Pinnacles National Monument, which is east of Monterey, became the country's 59th national park. So how does this change our interaction with a place? And what are we learning about bringing people into wilderness without harming that wilderness? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable. We'll talk with journalists about the week's news coverage. And today we're talking with Nathaniel Johnson. He's the author of the new book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover if the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And we're exploring the two conflicting mindsets. On the one hand, the idea that we should live in harmony with nature and that all natural is the best way to live. And on the other hand, the quest for scientific knowledge and technological advancement and the idea that humans can control nature. And Nathaniel will be in conversation with Michael Pollan tomorrow evening, Thursday at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. We have a link to how to get tickets to that event at yourcallradio.org. And I believe when you sign up, you also get a copy of Nate's book, All Natural.
Right.
So Gina brought up two kind of big questions. One is, how do you reconcile dietary needs with these ethical questions? And the second is, you know, we live in a very consumer society, very materialistic. How do we begin to question those values? And it seems like, you know, the Bay Area, Northern California, Santa Cruz is ground zero in doing a lot of that questioning.
Sure. Well, she talked about leaky gut syndrome and candida, which these are sort of the buzzwords at this point. And I think that they're often used to describe a large variety of symptoms that that may extend beyond those actual problems. But there certainly is something real that's going on here with the fact that we evolved in this microbial soup. And and we've really done our best to distance ourselves from those bacterial friends that we had. And we're paying a price for that. I'm seeing these effects in autoimmune disorders, allergy, asthma, and more serious ones like type 1 diabetes. There's a lot of evidence linking type 1 diabetes to gut health and having a diverse population of gut flora. So, you know, the science is still fuzzy on this. We know that there's something real here. We don't know exactly how to solve it yet. But there are a lot of people doing interesting work and creating inroads in that way. And I think, you know, as far as the consumerism part of this, that ultimately is sort of the elephant in the room. lurking behind all of these things. There's this drive I talk about in the book, the continuous wanting. We're always wanting, and we're very rarely actually liking. And I think we've actually confused pleasure and desire. So we sort of live in this culture of continuous desire, always striving after the next thing, and when we get it, getting very little satisfaction from that. So part of this is about learning to take satisfaction.
And you've set it up as this duality, but it doesn't necessarily have to be framed that way. You know what? I think I've got a caller who has something on this. Anna in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call.
Hi, thank you. I this is really an interesting topic. I had to pull over for all this time because it's exciting. And I think your writer there seems like someone I would have a lot of commonality with. And I think that every time we do present this as a duality, we further it as a duality and create this, like, almost red state, blue state kind of problem that just continues. I grew up on a small rural community in eastern Oregon in the 1960s, very conventional, very conservative. Moved to Santa Cruz, had home births with my kids, raised two kids completely on organic food. Their young adults are doing really great. They eat organic food. They live so simply on the planet. Very don't have cars. I mean, very simple living. And they do have computers. They do understand technology. They did go to college and all of that. So I think, you know, they didn't have to choose. They didn't feel like they had to choose. They just knew how to live simply and also be part of the culture they live in. And I have a community garden project in Watsonville where I work with farm workers, organic gardens, and every one of those people is so happy to have organic food, even though I was told, oh, it wouldn't matter to them. But they work in pesticides all the time. They just can't afford organic food. So we mostly call it pesticide-free because in that community, organic is not such a favored term. It's a conventional agriculture mecca, but it doesn't mean people don't want to eat it. So
what's the name of your community garden?
Mesa Verde Gardens.
All right.
Mesa Verde Gardens.
Four community gardens. We're starting a community orchard in a couple weeks. And I just think every time we say, well, we do this and they do that, then we continue the we and they rather than how do we all, you know,
let me speak to that
and do it together. So I really appreciate the topic, and that's
great. Great to have your call. And I mean, Nate's background sounds a lot like your kids.
I wonder what their reaction to the book would be. I think that you're absolutely right. As I was struggling to say, okay, what really is the natural and what is the technological? And the harder you look at that dividing line, the hazier it becomes. And I think it's less to do with the way that we look at nature and the way that we look at science. And it's less to do with actual nature and more to do with the way that we look at it. It says a lot about us, our divisions that we make, and not a lot about what actually exists out in the world.
Well, and Nate, there's a good example of this in the book, which is that this kind of came into conflict in your own life when your wife got pregnant and you had very different approaches toward childbirth, and it made you question this kind of all natural approach, which is, you know, you do a home birth with a midwife and not a hospital. So tell us about that, because it does kind of draw this out.
Right, exactly. I was born at home in Berkeley, and the stories that my parents told me about that really made it sound like this idyllic experience, and I really wanted that for my kids. And my wife was born in a hospital via scheduled cesarean section in Florida. And so we came from very different backgrounds, and we really needed to negotiate. And we did a lot of research together and tried to figure out what was the right thing to do. And to make a long story short, one of the real keys from my research was that it's very important for women to be comfortable during birth. And this is something, the way that women feel is something, the way that patients feel in general is something that the medical system does a bad job at understanding. But these feelings affect hormones, and those hormones are the same hormones that lead to a successful birth. And in the end, my wife was really more comfortable in a hospital, and I, uh, I absolutely had to respect that. And we found a hospital here. We're blessed to live in the Bay Area where people are paying attention. And this hospital really had a great system led by midwives, very up to date and with the science.
Well, we have a wonderful caller, Laura in San Francisco, who's grappling with this right now. Hi, Laura. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, I was just struck by this topic and my own experience with having had two children here in San Francisco and how naively I went into my first pregnancy thinking like, oh, I can sort of take the best of both approaches. Both of my parents are physicians, so I'm, you know, super comfortable around doctors and medical professionals, but how sort of judged and dictated to I felt by the natural childbirth movement here mm-hmm. in San Francisco, how there is very little room for kind of an integrative approach, I feel like, from that side, whereas I felt like my medical professionals were much more open to, you know, sort of taking the best of both sides as long as mother and baby's safety were guaranteed.
How interesting.
Yes. I mean, I was shocked. I was shocked at how vehemently sort of anti-pain relief, sort of assuming the worst about doctors and hospitals and their intentions, I found that side to be. And I just thought how sad that we have to make women feel less than for wanting pain relief in what can be a very long, arduous process.
Absolutely.
And incredibly painful. And this glorification of having done it the natural way, sort of at whatever cost, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bragging about 36-hour childbirths, you know, where they're...
yep. It's like you're a marathon runner. Afterward.
And, yeah. You know, it's unfortunate. And I haven't, you know, I agree with you that we're blessed to be sort of bringing children into the world in this part of the country where doctors really are sort of more savvy about both approaches.
And where we're really marrying some of this, yeah.
Yeah, but the other side of it, I think you're right. That it's sort of because we're much more progressive and because the hospitals are paying attention to the science, and in some ways the natural childbirth movement is even farther polarized to the other extreme because they're sort of serving that community that's not comfortable with the hospitals, even with these very progressive integrative approaches.
Well, and I know myself in childbirth, I felt that I had failed because I ended up, you know, being on every medicine in the book, begging for an epidural and having a cesarean in the end. And I really honestly, because of this kind of glorification of the all natural approach, I thought I had completely failed at this endeavor.
And you're just getting started at the endeavor. You know, the birth is over and then the hard part begins, right? And so we really need to support women and not beat them up.
And let me read an email and then I'll go to Maria. The email says, regarding materialism and teenagers, I find this to be a real challenge. Materialism is based in insecurity, which kids have in spades. Trying to teach teens not to be like a small number of snobbish consumers is much different from trying to teach them not to be like all of their friends. The eventual rewards are worth it, but it has made raising kids much harder, to say nothing of the fact that advertising has gotten very good at bypassing parent filters, which is one of the things that you find as your kids get older, that you may have, you know, raised them without sugar or TV, but once they go out into the world, my friends, all of those things are available.
Yeah, my daughter is only a year and a half, so I still have all of this in front of me, but I definitely found that with myself, you know, as in some ways being sheltered from sugar and TV. You know, the first time I saw MTV, I thought, like, this is the life that everybody else is living, and I am missing out on it. Where do I buy those jeans so that I can, you know, have a beautiful supermodel girlfriend as well? So there's, yeah, it is extremely tricky, and I think that the question might contain the answer to it, that the source is insecurity, and so raising secure, confident, smart kids can help defuse that.
critical thinkers. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with Nathaniel Johnson, who's the author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And he's going to be in conversation with Michael Pollan tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. We have a link to that event at yourcallradio.org. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. How do you define natural, which is something I'd like to ask Nate? And if you're trying to live consciously and ecologically, do you find that technology is helpful? How do you balance those two competing, in some ways, things in our lives? And let's go to Maria in Mountain View. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Well, first of all, I do love this topic, and I also had to pull over and give you a call because it's wonderful. I grew up in Pomona, California, but my parents immigrated here from a small village in Mexico.
Mm.
So it's very, you know, this, we talk about organic, and I was commenting to another friend who moved over here from Mexico about how everything over here, you know, organic is so pricey. But in Mexico, we joked, everything is organic,
right?
Because they have to grow it themselves. And the meat thing, you know, you can't afford meat, really. Things like that as far as the diet. So now, that's my son.
Nice.
He says, Donovan says hi. So now I myself also, a college graduate with an, you know, educated. But I also, just until recently, am really, you know, embracing technology because I'm not a very good cook. But, yeah, but all that technology, love it. But at the same time, you know, growing up with parents who, I feel I'm very healthy, but a lot of it, you know, I was in Mexico till I was 5. My mom said she gave me everything fresh.
Mm.
Because, right, and organic, you know, she didn't use organic, but I'm pretty sure it was. And I'm very healthy. So three of us, I'm the oldest of six. So three of us are, you know, raised on a lot of Mexican food from when we were little. So our basic nutrition, or our base nutrition. And then three of us are born here and raised on food over here. And I find that our health is different.
Yeah.
And I always,
this is very well shown in the literature. It's something called the immigrant effect, where people who move to the United States are much healthier than U.S. citizens, and then the next generation is much less healthy than their parents. And there's, I mean, when we talk about improving medicine, everybody who's looking at the big picture understands that the environmental and social determinants of health are what we've got to fix. These things are just sinking us in terms of our health and in terms of the cost. And yet, every time we come up with a solution, it seems to be like, well, maybe we can give everyone these statins, and then they'll have less cholesterol.
Let's go. We have a lot of callers and only a little bit of time, so I want to try and get to as many callers as possible. Jeff in Oakland, welcome to your call.
Hey, how's it going? Just call real quick. I just wanted to know what your thoughts were about baby formula, because we had to embrace that, the technology of feeding our baby through baby
right.
form from day one. And it's not that I'm like comparing it to a breastfed child. My daughter, who's 11 months, she seems so much bigger.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're talking about how they're growing pigs bigger, you know, to get more out of it, well, why not take that technology and grow humans bigger, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I was just wondering. I just wanted to hear what you had to say about
that. So which kid is bigger, the breastfed baby?
Oh, it's my daughter, the formula-fed baby. It's weird.
Oh, interesting.
All my friends who are breastfed, they have really smaller kids.
Mm.
She just seems more like, I don't know, maybe it's just me. You know, I'm 6'2", 300 pounds. My wife's 5'4", you know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's also easier. You can drink faster from a bottle than you can from a boob.
Yeah. It's, you know, there is a lot of really interesting science on this, and there are people, I definitely know that there's people who know that, they say that they can pick up the 3-year-old and tell if they're a breastfed baby or not by their conformity. But
please.
But I think that, you know, look,
the breast milk is different, and it's more, there are things that we still haven't figured out and haven't been able to match it with formula, but the formula is really good, and they improve it every year, and we, you know, there are a lot of situations where it really makes sense to use formula.
And if you don't have a choice, what are you going to do? And
exactly.
Yet this sort of, you know, all-natural approach makes you feel so guilty about having to make a choice like that, that you're, you know, this kid, the thing that matters most to you in the world, that you're doing them wrong. Let's go to Liz in Berkeley. Hi, Liz. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I really am, I'm a doula, so I'm really enjoying this conversation that we're having.
Great.
Great.
Two things. In terms of the breastfeeding, I just wanted to comment on that. The World Health Organization says if you can't breastfeed, the next thing is you should go to pumped breast milk. And after that, milk bank breast milk. And then after that, formula. So I think, you know, if we could find a way in society to increase the amount of milk banks we have, I know the Bay Area is sort of leading the way in that, but that would be something nice to see. In terms of,
and that's good for people to know about, that that's a resource out there if you, for some reason, can't breastfeed.
Yeah.
So thank you. Yeah, go on, yeah. Liz.
And the last thing is, in terms of a doula, I have a lot of clients around here who oftentimes will, through prenatal meetings, will say, oh, I don't want an epidural. I don't want any drugs. I don't want any drugs. And then they get to the point where, you know, they've been awake for 24, 30 hours, and their cervix isn't dilating, and they're just exhausted.
Exhausted,
and,
yeah.
And they choose to get an epidural, which, as a doula, I don't judge. That's fine. And then they say, you know, I'm so sorry. To me, they say, I'm so sorry I'm getting it. I'm so sorry. And I'm like, no, this is not, there's no guilt around, you know, my personal beliefs should not influence your decision in your birth. And I think there are times when an epidural is absolutely so helpful. And then there are times when I've seen a baby's heart rate drop because of the epidural and the mom ends up in the OR because the pushing wasn't working or the narcotics in the epidural affected the baby. And so you have to find the fine balance between knowing when the technology is helpful and when alternatives can be used.
Perfect. Perfect segue to Nate. Liz, I'm just going to cut in here because we're running out of time and I want to get a response.
Well, I think, yeah, I think... You said it. You know, I don't know. I guess if the epidural is put in incorrectly, that could lead to baby's heart rate just dropping like that. Normally, that shouldn't be related. But it's a fine. You need the right dexterity to get that in just right.
And let me read an email here from Joe. The language you're using is inherently problematic. To imagine that we are in any way different from the rest of life as opposed to irrevocably and inherently embedded and continuous with what we like to call nature is part of the hubris inherent in the human quest to distinguish ourselves from the large movement that is a life. Nature and natural are loaded words that actually communicate very little that is useful. So why don't you talk about how you define natural?
Yeah, I think he's actually right about that. That when we, the way that we look, so we have these two opposite contradictory perspectives about nature. On the one hand, nature wants to eat us. And, you know, we protect ourselves from nature with technology. From the first time that cavemen rolled rocks in front of their doors to prevent the saber-toothed tigers from getting in. But on the other hand, nature is abundant and nurturing. Nature wants to feed us. And the reason, and both of these things are true, right? And the reason that both of those things can be true, even though they're contradictory, is that it's not really about nature. It's about the way we look at nature. And I think that the human mind really does have these two contradictory ways of looking at the world, one which is focused on the small details and tends to favor mechanical solutions, and one that looks at the big picture and the way that things are completely interconnected.
And in your book, you talk about the right brain and the left brain and how that duality is evident there. Let's try and get to Kathy in Clayton. Hi, Kathy. Try to be brief because we're running out of time.
Okay, I just was calling. I am originally from the Bay Area, moved to Minnesota because I was kind of raised in the same environment Nate was, you know, all natural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had four kids, and all my kids were premature, and I needed medical assistance
yep.
to have my kids. And and I worked on a hog farm. I completely understand the whole theory that you're discussing, but I think preservatives that we put into our food are more harmful than what we are doing to maintain a balance of food.
Kathy, we're running out of time. Do you have a question?
Are you saying that they should not use those methods to mass produce food?
Okay, good. Let's get this to Nate, because this will actually give us to what conclusions have you reached here in terms of these balances?
Well, I think that there's a lot of room for innovation still. I mean, that we haven't done that much work. All of our agricultural colleges have been focused on fixing the problems created by the last fix and pushing this one style of food production forward. And there's this whole field of ecology that really gets short shrift. You know, I don't think we can step away from our mass food production system tomorrow, but there are a lot of people doing amazing things and producing a lot of food on a very small amount of land when they start thinking about the systems view, and then they start looking at the way that species interact rather than just maximizing one species and one efficiency at a time.
And let's try Dennis in Santa Cruz. Are you still there? Oh, I think we lost Dennis. Sorry. All right. So, Nate, just to kind of conclude, how did you end your book? How did you end this skeptic's quest? Or obviously it's going to continue.
Right. the skeptic's task is never over. I think, so, you know, I talked about these two perspectives, and I think it's really important to balance these two. The people that I found that were in the middle, that weren't just polarized and saying, this is the right way, the people who are really innovating in these fields of immunology and food production and forestry and working on the deeper problems at the heart of our broken medical system, these people were looking at the big picture, but then they were going and taking these detailed approaches to get the facts right as well. And so I think if we're guided by this sort of natural perspective, and then are able to tap on these reductive methods, we're really going to move things forward.
And that's Nathaniel Johnson. He's the author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And you can continue this conversation with Nate. He'll be with Michael Pollan in conversation tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at Book Passage at the Ferry Building in San Francisco. You can get tickets by going to yourcallradio.org. I want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, my gosh. It's so great to be here.
And thanks to everybody who called and for your emails. I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. We'll put web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org, and you can also leave comments there and continue this conversation. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What does it take to preserve wild land today? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the value of national parks. Just this month, President Obama signed a bill making the Pinnacles National Monument the nation's 59th national park. How does this change our interaction with the place? Climbers love Pinnacles, and conservationists are trying to protect the endangered condor. What are we learning about bringing people into nature without harming the wilderness? Join us at 10. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.